This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of proximal humerus fractures from the trauma section on orthobullets.com. Starting with a brief summary, proximal humerus fractures are common fractures often seen in older patients with osteoporotic bone following a ground-level fall on an outstretched arm. Diagnosis is made with orthogonal radiographs of the shoulder, and typically treatment is either with sling immobilization, which is indicated for minimally displaced fractures, or surgical fixation versus arthroplasty, which is indicated in more complex and displaced fractures. In this episode, we will discuss the epidemiology, etiology, anatomy, clinical presentation, imaging, treatment, techniques, and complications related to proximal humerus fractures. Beginning with the epidemiology, the incidence of proximal humerus fractures is relatively common, making up 4 to 6% of all fractures, and it is the third most common non-vertebral fracture pattern seen in elderly patients greater than 65 years old. Of all types of proximal humerus fractures, two-part surgical neck fractures are the most common. Important demographics to note include a 2-to-1 female-to-male incidence ratio for proximal humerus fractures, and an increased age is associated with a more complex fracture type. Regarding the anatomic location of proximal humerus fractures, they may occur at the surgical neck, anatomic neck, greater tuberosity, and lesser tuberosity. Again, two-part surgical neck fractures are the most common type. Moving on to discuss the risk factors for proximal humerus fractures, they include osteoporosis, diabetes, epilepsy, and a female gender. Moving on to discuss the etiology of proximal humerus fractures, the pathophysiology often relates to the mechanism. This is divided as low-energy falls or high-energy trauma. Proximal humerus fractures from low-energy falls are seen in elderly patients with osteoporotic bone, whereas proximal humerus fractures in high-energy trauma are often seen in young individuals and have a high rate of concomitant soft tissue and neurovascular injuries. Important pathoanatomy to note regarding proximal humerus fractures is that the vascularity of the articular segment is more likely to be preserved if greater than or equal to 8 mm of the medial calcar is attached to the articular segment. The predictors of humeral head ischemia are known as hurdle criteria. These include less than 8 mm of distance of the calcar length attached to the articular segment, a disrupted medial hinge, increased fracture complexity, displacement greater than 10 millimeters, and an angulation greater than 45 degrees. It is important to note that these predictors of humeral head ischemia do not necessarily predict subsequent avascular necrosis. Conditions associated with proximal humerus fracture include nerve and arterial injuries. The axillary nerve is the most commonly injured nerve. An arterial injury is relatively uncommon with an incidence of 5 to 6% and is higher in likelihood in older patients. Most often, arterial injuries occur at the level of the surgical neck or with subcoracoid dislocation of the head. We will now move on to discuss some important points regarding the anatomy of proximal humerus fractures. We will discuss the osteology, musculature, ligaments, and blood supply that is important in consideration for proximal humerus fractures. Beginning with the osteology, the anatomic neck represents the old epiphyseal plate, while the surgical neck represents the weakened area below the head. This surgical neck is more often involved in fractures than the anatomic neck. Notably, the average neck shaft angle is 135 degrees. Moving on to discuss the musculature that is important in proximal humerus fractures, remember that the pectoralis major displaces the shaft anteriorly and medially, while the supraspinatus, infraspinatus, and teres minor externally rotate the greater tuberosity, and the subscapularis internally rotates the articular segment or the lesser tuberosity. The relevant ligaments to be aware of include the coracohumeral ligament, the superior glenohumeral ligament or the SGHL, the middle glenohumeral ligament or MGHL, and the inferior glenohumeral ligament or IGHL. The coracohumeral ligament attaches to the coracoid and the greater tuberosity and strengthens the rotator interval. The superior glenohumeral ligament provides a restraint to inferior translation at 0 degrees of abduction and neutral rotation. The middle glenohumeral ligament resists AP translation in the midrange about 45 degrees of abduction, and the inferior glenohumeral ligament provides restraint to AP translation at 90 degrees of abduction. Our last note on anatomy will be regarding the blood supply. The main blood supply is the anterior humeral circumflex artery, which provides a large number of anastomoses with other vessels in the proximal humerus. The anterior humeral circumflex artery branches to become the anterolateral ascending branch, and the arcuate artery is the terminal branch and main supply to the greater tuberosity. Regarding the posterior humeral circumflex artery, some recent studies suggest it is the main blood supply to the humeral head. Moving on to discuss classification of proximal humerus fractures, we will discuss the AO/OTA classification and the NEAR classification. The AO/OTA classification organizes fractures into three main groups and additional subgroups based on fracture location, status of the surgical neck, and the presence or absence of dislocation. While the NEAR classification is based on anatomic relationships of four segments, the greater tuberosity, lesser tuberosity, articular surface, and the humeral shaft. A piece is considered a separate part if displacement of the fragment is greater than 1 centimeter or greater than 45 degrees angulated. In the NEAR classification, proximal humerus fractures can be classified as minimally displaced, two-part, three-part, or four-part based on these definitions of separate parts. Again, the parts are the greater tuberosity, lesser tuberosity, articular surface, and humeral shaft, and the parts are considered separate if the displacement is greater than 1 centimeter or greater than 45 degrees angulated. Clinical presentation of proximal humerus fractures present with pain and swelling, as well as decreased motion. On physical examination, inspection reveals extensive ecchymosis of the chest, arm, and forearm. It is important to obtain a good neurovascular exam, with axillary nerve injury being most common. In order to test this, determine the function of the deltoid muscle and test lateral shoulder sensation. Note that arterial injury may be masked by extensive collateral circulation preserving the distal pulses. In patients presenting with proximal humerus fractures, also examine for concomitant chest wall injuries. Moving on to discuss imaging, radiographs are recommended with views including a complete trauma series, which includes a true AP of the shoulder or a Gracie view, a scapular Y, and an axillary view. Additional views that may be obtained include an apical oblique view, a Velpeau view, or a West Point axillary view. Notable findings to look out for on X-rays include combined cortical thickness, with the addition of medial plus lateral wall thickness being greater than 4 millimeters. In studies, this suggests correlation with an increased lateral plate pullout strength. Other findings include pseudosubluxation, which is an inferior humeral head subluxation which is caused by blood in the capsule and muscular atony. A CT scan may be indicated for preoperative planning, humeral head or greater tuberosity position evaluation, intraarticular comminution, and concern for a head split fracture. MRI, on the other hand, is rarely indicated, though it may be useful to identify associated rotator cuff injury. We will now move on to discuss the non-operative and operative treatment options for proximal humerus fractures. Non-operative treatment with sling immobilization followed by progressive rehabilitation is indicated for most proximal humerus fractures. The indications for non-operative treatment of proximal humerus fractures include minimally displaced surgical and anatomic neck fractures, greater tuberosity fractures displace less than 5 millimeters. Note that fractures displaced greater than 5 millimeters will result in impingement with loss of abduction and external rotation in the shoulder. And non-operative treatment is recommended in patients with fractures who are not surgical candidates. Additional variables to consider when choosing non-operative treatment include age of the patient, fracture type, fracture displacement, the bone quality, arm dominance, general medical condition, and concurrent injuries. If choosing non-operative treatment, note that immediate physical therapy results in faster recovery. Moving on to discuss the operative treatment options, we will discuss CRPP, ORIF, intramedullary nailing, and arthroplasty options. Regarding close reduction percutaneous pinning, or CRPP, this is indicated for two-part surgical neck fractures or three-part and valgus-impacted four-part fractures in patients with good bone quality, minimal metaphyseal comminution, and an intact medial calcar. Concerning outcomes, CRPP has a considerably higher complication rate compared to ORIF, hemiarthroplasty, and reverse shoulder arthroplasty. Notably, the axillary nerve is at risk with the lateral pins. the musculocutaneous nerve, cephalic vein, and biceps tendon are all at risk with the anterior pins. Moving on to discuss open reduction internal fixation, ORIF is indicated for greater tuberosity fractures, displaced greater than 5 millimeters, displaced two-part fractures, 3- and 4-part fractures in younger patients, and head-splitting fractures in younger patients. Outcomes of proximal humerus ORIF rely largely on the medial support and calcar screw placement. Medial support is necessary for fractures with posteromedial comminution, and the use of a fibular strut should be considered if concerned about the medial support or bone quality. And calcar screw placement is critical to decrease varus collapse of the head. Moving on to discuss intramedullary nailing, this is indicated for surgical neck fractures or 3-part greater tuberosity fractures in younger patients. Combined proximal humerus fractures and humeral shaft fractures should also be considered for intramedullary nailing. Regarding the outcomes of IM nailing, biomechanically, they have been shown to be inferior with torsional stress compared with plates, though they have shown favorable rates of fracture healing and range of motion compared to ORIF. The last treatment option we'll touch on is arthroplasty. This is indicated with either hemiarthroplasty or reverse total shoulder. Hemiarthroplasty is indicated in younger patients between 40 to 65 years old with complex fracture dislocations or head-splitting components that may fail fixation. Recommended use of a convertible stem to permit easier conversion to reverse shoulder arthroplasty if necessary in the future is recommended. Reverse total shoulder is indicated in low, elderly demanded individuals with non-reconstructable tuberosities and poor bone stock. Older patients with fracture dislocations are also candidates for reverse total shoulder. Outcomes of arthroplasty are improved with anatomic tuberosity reduction and healing and restoration of humeral height and version. Humeral height is best judged from the superior border of the pectoralis major insertion. Note that there are poor results with arthroplasty if tuberosity non-union or malunion takes place, as well as with retroversion of the humeral component greater than 40 degrees. We will now move on to discuss treatments by their fracture types. We will discuss 2-part, 3-part, and 4-part proximal humerus fractures. Starting with 2-part fractures, fractures of the surgical neck of the humerus are the most common fracture pattern. The deforming forces in these surgical neck fractures include the pectoralis major pulling the shaft anterior and medial, while the head and attached tuberosities stay neutral. Non-operative treatment with closed reduction and sling immobilization is often possible. Operative indications are controversial, and techniques can include CRPP, plate fixation, and IM devices. Regarding greater tuberosity 2-part humerus fractures, these are often missed, and the deforming forces include the greater tuberosity being pulled superior and posterior by the supraspinatus, infraspinatus, and teres minor. The greater tuberosity can only accept minimal displacement, less than 5 mm, or else it will block external rotation and abduction. Non-operative treatment of greater tuberosity fractures is indicated for displacement less than 5 mm, whereas operative intervention is indicated for greater tuberosity displacement greater than 5 mm. Regarding technique for greater tuberosity fixation, isolated screw fixation is only indicated in young patients with good bone stock, whereas a non-absorbable suture technique should be used for osteoporotic bone, which avoids hardware due to impingement. Tension band wiring may also be considered for greater tuberosity fixation. Moving on to discuss lesser tuberosity fractures, patients with lesser tuberosity fractures should be assumed to have a posterior dislocation until proven otherwise. Non-operative intervention is indicated for minimally or non-displaced fractures of the lesser tuberosity, whereas operative intervention with open reduction internal fixation used if large fragments are present, or fragment excision with rotator cuff repair if a small fragment is present. Last among the 2-part fractures are anatomic neck fractures, which are rare, and non-operative intervention is indicated for minimally or non-displaced fragments, whereas operative intervention is indicated in certain scenarios with open reduction internal fixation being indicated in young patients and ORIF versus hemiarthroplasty or reverse total shoulder arthroplasty being indicated in elderly patients. Moving on to discuss 3-part proximal humerus fractures, fractures of the surgical neck and greater tuberosity of the humerus present with internal rotation of the articular segments secondary to the subscapularis and are often associated with longitudinal rotator cuff tears. Non-operative intervention of greater tuberosity and surgical neck fractures is indicated for a minimally displaced greater tuberosity less than 5 mm and an articular segment less than 1 cm displaced and less than 45 degrees angulated. Non-operative treatment is also indicated for poor surgical candidates. Operative intervention of these injuries is indicated for young patients with percutaneous pinning, which provides good results, but you must be aware to protect the axillary nerve. The intramedullary nail fixation does violate the cuff, but it is also an option. Locking plates provide poor results with a high rate of avascular necrosis, impingement, infection, and malunion. Treatment of surgical neck and greater tuberosity fractures in elderly patients should be considered for hemiarthroplasty with rotator cuff repair or tuberosity repair versus a reverse total shoulder arthroplasty. Regarding surgical neck and lesser tuberosity three-part proximal humerus fractures, the unopposed pull of the posterior cuff musculature leads to the articular surface being pointed anterior. These fractures are also often associated with longitudinal rotator cuff tears. With fractures of the surgical neck and lesser tuberosity, there is a general trend towards non-operative management, given the high rate of complications with open reduction internal fixation. Treatment options are basically the same as previously discussed, with young patients being candidates for percutaneous pinning, which provides good results, but you must again protect the axillary nerve. Intramedullary fixation, again, may violate the cuff. And locking plates can provide poor results with high rates of AVN, impingement, infection, and possibly malunion. While in elderly patients, consideration for hemiarthroplasty with rotator cuff repair or tuberosity repair versus reverse total shoulder arthroplasty should be considered. Lastly, regarding four-part proximal humerus fractures, valgus-impacted four-part humerus fractures will appear radiographically to be aligned between the medial shaft and the head segments. In these fractures, there is low rate of AVN if the posterior medial component is intact, thus preserving the intraosseous blood supply. Important notes on surgical technique include that you must raise the articular surface and fill defects, often requiring a fibular strut allograft, and you must repair the tuberosities. Regarding four-part head-splitting fractures of the proximal humerus, these are characterized by high rates of AVN between 21 to 75%, with deforming forces pulling the shaft medially by the pectoralis. In young patients, treatment with open reduction internal fixation versus hemiarthroplasty may be considered. Note that hemiarthroplasty is favored for non-reconstructable articular surfaces, severe head splits, and extruded anatomic neck fractures. Elderly patients with four-part head-splitting proximal humerus fractures should be treated with hemiarthroplasty versus reverse total shoulder arthroplasty. We will now move on to discuss non-operative and operative techniques for treatment of proximal humerus fractures. With non-operative treatment, sling immobilization followed by progressive rehabilitation should be undertaken. Sling can be worn for 2 to 3 weeks for comfort, and immediate physical therapy should be started for early range of motion. Regarding the operative techniques, we will discuss CRPP, ORIF, intramedullary nailing, hemiarthroplasty, and reverse shoulder arthroplasty. Regarding CRPP, the approach is, of course, percutaneous. Regarding the technique, threaded pins should be used that do not cross the cartilage layer. The shoulder should be externally rotated during pin placement, and the goal of pin placement should be to engage the cortex 2 cm inferior to the inferior border of the humeral head. Complications with CRPP include risk of injury to the axillary nerve with lateral pinning, and risk of the injury to the biceps tendon, musculocutaneous nerve, and cephalic vein with anterior pinning. There is also the risk of possible pin migration. Moving on to discuss ORIF, the approach is either anterior with a deltopectoral approach or lateral with a deltoid splitting approach. The lateral approach increases the risk of axillary nerve injury. The technique for ORIF can be either with heavy non-absorbable sutures, isolated screw fixation, or locking plate fixation. The heavy non-absorbable suture technique may be used as a figure of eight technique used for isolated greater tuberosity fracture reduction and fixation. This technique avoids hardware placement due to the risk of impingement. Isolated screw fixation may also be used for greater tuberosity fracture reduction and fixation, but this is indicated in younger patients with good bone stock. Regarding locking plate fixation, it is notable that there is a high risk of screw cutout, up to 14%, and is the most common complication following ORIF with a periarticular locking plate. Note that locking plates are more elastic than blade plates, making them a better option in osteoporotic bone. The plate should be placed lateral to the bicipital groove and the pectoralis major tendon to avoid injury to the ascending branch of the anterior humeral circumflex artery. And placement of an inferomedial calcar screw can prevent postoperative varus collapse, especially in osteoporotic bone. Regarding postoperative rehabilitation following ORIF, note that this is an important part of management. The best results are with guided protocols in a three-phase program, beginning with early passive range of motion, then graduating to active range of motion and progressive resistance, and finally moving into an advanced stretching and strengthening program. Note that prolonged immobilization leads to shoulder stiffness. Moving on to review intramedullary nailing, the approach is a superior deltoid splitting approach. And regarding technique, locked nails should be used with trauma or pathologic fractures. Note that regarding implant design, straight nails are placed through the superior articular cartilage with a more central entry point, whereas nails with the proximal bend are placed through an entry point just medial to the rotator cuff insertion. Complications of humeral intramedullary nailing include rod migration in older patients with osteoporotic bone as a concern, and shoulder pain from violating the rotator cuff. There is also the risk of nerve injury with interlocking screw placement, with the radial nerve being at risk with lateral to medial distal screw placement, and the musculocutaneous nerve being at risk with anterior to posterior distal screw placement. Moving on to discuss hemiarthroplasty, the approach is through an anterior or deltopectoral approach. Regarding the technique for hemiarthroplasty in proximal humerus fractures, cerclage wires or sutures should be passed through a hole in the prosthesis and tuberosities to improve fracture stability. The greater tuberosity should be placed about 8 mm below the articular surface of the humeral head. This is otherwise known as the head-to-tuberosity distance, or the HTD. Note that non-anatomic placement of the tuberosities results in impairment in external rotation kinematics with an 8-fold increase in torque requirements. The height of the prosthesis is best determined off the superior edge of the pectoralis major tendon, noting a distance of 5.6 centimeters between the top of the humeral head and the superior edge of the tendon. Note that postoperative passive external rotation places the most stress on the lesser tuberosity fragment. The last technique we will cover is reverse shoulder arthroplasty. The approach for reverse shoulder arthroplasty may be either through an anterior or deltopectoral approach or an anterolateral deltoid split approach. The technique for fracture care with reverse shoulder arthroplasty should ensure adequate glenoid bone stock as well as a functioning deltoid muscle. Repair of the tuberosities is recommended despite the ability of the reverse shoulder arthroplasty design to compensate for non-functioning tuberosities or the rotator cuff, and repair of the tuberosities has been shown to improve range of motion. We will lastly discuss complications of treatment for proximal humerus fractures. These include screw cutout, avascular necrosis, nerve injury, malunion, non-union, rotator cuff injuries and dysfunction, long head of the biceps tendon injuries, missed posterior dislocations, adhesive capsulitis and scar tissue, post-traumatic arthritis, and infection. Again, screw cutout is the most common complication following periarticular locking plate fixation, with an incidence up to 14%. Regarding avascular necrosis, the risk factors for humeral head ischemia are not the same for developing subsequent avascular necrosis. Avascular necrosis of the humeral head is better tolerated than in the lower extremity and has no relationship to the type of fixation used with either plate or cerclage wires. Regarding nerve injuries, the incidence of axillary nerve injury is most common, with up to 58% of patients having positive EMG studies. There is an increased risk with the lateral or deltoid splitting approach, and note that the axillary nerve is usually found approximately 5 to 7 centimeters distal to the tip of the acromion. Note that the axillary nerve is also at risk with the lateral pins in CRPP. There is also a risk of injury to the suprascapular nerve, with EMG showing up to 48% of patients having suprascapular nerve issues, as well as risks to the musculocutaneous nerve with anterior pinning in CRPP. Regarding malunion, malunion often takes the form of varus apex anterior or malunion of the greater tuberosity. Notably, the results of converting a varus malunited fracture to a total shoulder arthroplasty are inferior, and thus a reverse shoulder arthroplasty should be used instead. Moving on to discuss non-union, this is most common after two-part surgical neck fractures. Note that the treatment of chronic non-unions and malunions in the elderly should include arthroplasty. Non-unions of the lesser tuberosity will lead to weakness with liftoff testing, while non-union of the greater tuberosity, after arthroplasty, leads to lack of active shoulder elevation. The greatest risk factors for non-union are age and smoking. Regarding the risk of injury to the long head of the biceps tendon, remember that these are at risk with anterior pinning in CRPP, and the risk of missing a posterior dislocation should be considered in all patients with the noted lesser tuberosity fracture. Now that we've gotten a general overview of this topic, let's review a few questions to see how this material has been tested in the past. Question 1. A 76-year-old left-handed female presents to your office after a fall in which she sustains a 4-part proximal humerus fracture. When treating this fracture with hemiarthroplasty, which of the following is the most important for a successful outcome? Is it 1. Anatomic healing of the tuberosities? 2. Stem retroversion of 25 degrees? 3. Surgical fixation within 24 hours? 4. Anterior superior labral repair? Or 5. Age over 75? The correct answer is 1. Anatomic healing of the tuberosities. When performing a hemiarthroplasty for a displaced 4-part proximal humerus fracture, the best predictor of a surgical outcome is anatomic healing of the tuberosities. Although most proximal humerus fractures can be treated non-operatively, especially in elderly low-demand patients, some debate remains regarding the use of a hemiarthroplasty versus reverse total shoulder arthroplasty. When performing a hemiarthroplasty for a displaced 4-part proximal humerus fracture, it is of the utmost importance to achieve a stable and anatomic reduction of the tuberosities. Studies have shown that malpositioned or migrated tuberosities leads to stiffness, weakness, and persistent pain. Restoration of humeral height and version is also important for successful outcomes of hemiarthroplasty. Rangan et al., in the PROFER trial, studied the outcomes of patients with displaced proximal humerus fractures treated with surgical versus non-surgical intervention. Of note, in the surgical group, 83% of patients were treated with ORIF, 9% were treated with hemiarthroplasty, and the remainder were treated with some other fixation method. They found no difference at 2 years between the surgical and non-surgical groups with regard to outcome scoring, complications from surgery or non-operative care, secondary surgery, new therapy requirements, or mortality. They concluded the current increase in surgery in patients with displaced proximal humerus fractures is not supported by the data. Boileau et al. Followed 66 patients with displaced proximal humerus fractures treated with hemiarthroplasty to evaluate for clinical and radiographic parameters that could lead to worse outcomes. They found that 50% of patients had malpositioning of the greater tuberosities, which correlated with unsatisfactory results, superior migration of the prosthesis, stiffness or weakness, and persistent pain. They concluded that the primary goal of arthroplasty for proximal humerus fractures should be obtaining anatomic tuberosity healing. Reviewing the incorrect answers, answer 2, stem retroversion of 25 degrees, is incorrect, as although appropriate retroversion is important for optimal function, anatomic healing of the tuberosities is felt to contribute more to successful outcomes. Answer 3, surgical fixation within 24 hours, is incorrect, as surgical timing has not been reported to be associated with improved outcomes in this fracture pattern. Answer 4, anterior superior labral repair is incorrect, as anterior superior labral repair would not be indicated and would be of little benefit in this setting. And answer 5, age over 75 is incorrect, as age over 75 has been shown to predict worse tuberosity healing and subsequent worse outcomes. Question 2. A primarily sedentary 76-year-old female falls and complains of left shoulder pain. Radiographs and CT scan demonstrate a proximal humerus fracture that is extensively comminuted and has anterior dislocation of the humeral head. She is vascularly intact but has decreased sensation over the lateral arm and ulnar hand with the inability to cross her fingers. Which of the following is the best option for definitive management? 1. Sling and serial examination for resolution of neuropraxia. 2. Closed reduction under conscious sedation in the emergency department. 3. Open reduction internal fixation. 4. Closed reduction percutaneous pinning. Or 5. Arthroplasty. The correct answer is 5. Arthroplasty. An elderly patient with low functional demands and a comminuted proximal humerus fracture dislocation with poor bone quality is best treated with a hemiarthroplasty or reverse total shoulder arthroplasty. Proximal humerus fracture dislocations in the elderly occur following low energy falls, resulting in significant comminution due to poor bone quality. Treatment of these fractures with open reduction internal fixation accepts a significant risk for loss of fixation, osteonecrosis, or screw penetration into the joint. Hemiarthroplasty can be considered, however, functional status largely depends on the healing of the tuberosities, which may be difficult in patients with poor bone quality. Acute reverse total shoulder arthroplasty in this setting of a low-demand elderly patient is associated with predictable functional outcomes with less reliance on the healing of the tuberosities. Robinson et al. Presented in their series of 58 patients with proximal humerus fracture dislocations treated with either open reduction or cemented hemiarthroplasty, they found those patients with complete detachment of capsular tissue and no back bleeding from the humeral head had a higher risk of going on to osteonecrosis. They conclude that patients less than 60 years of age with intact capsular attachments and humeral head bleeding can be treated with open reduction internal fixation, while patients greater than 60 years of age and no humeral head bleeding or capsular attachments are best treated with hemiarthroplasty. Demerhan et al. Presents 6 cases, an average of age 52, of iatrogenic fracture dislocations treated with primary arthroplasty. On average, they found that patients achieved 124 degrees of forward flexion, 29 degrees of external rotation, and internal rotation to L2. They conclude that primary arthroplasty is the ideal treatment in the setting of iatrogenic fracture dislocations given the high risk of avascular necrosis and humeral head collapse with open reduction internal fixation. Solberg et al. Reviewed 70 patients greater than 55 years of age with near 3 and 4 part proximal humerus fractures treated with locked plating. They found complication rates were as high as 79% in patients with initial varus deformity compared to 19% in patients with initial valgus deformity. They concluded that elderly patients with initial valgus angulation did better functionally and had lower complication rates compared to elderly patients with initial varus deformity. Reviewing the incorrect answers, answer 1, sling immobilization and serial examination for resolution of neuropraxia, is incorrect as treating the patient definitively in a sling would leave the humeral head dislocated and likely result in chronic pain, osteonecrosis, and loss of function. Answer 2, closed reduction under conscious sedation in the emergency department, is incorrect as closed reduction in the ER is not recommended, as gaining control of the humeral head in a fracture dislocation is often unsuccessful. Answer 3, open reduction internal fixation, is incorrect, as ORIF would not be recommended in this scenario given the expected humeral head necrosis and non-union. And answer 4 is incorrect, as closed reduction percutaneous pinning is associated with high complication rates and would be unlikely to lead to early return of function. Last question. While snowboarding on the steep slopes in New England, a 56-year-old active right-hand dominant man falls onto his right shoulder and sustains a right proximal humerus fracture. Which of the following fracture characteristics would most directly result in altered rotator cuff biomechanics after closed treatment? 1. Comminuted medial hinge. 2. Intact calcar length of 6 mm. 3. Greater tuberosity displacement of 6 mm. 4. Anatomical neck displacement of 8 mm. Or 5. Surgical neck displacement of 9 mm. The correct answer is 3. Greater tuberosity displacement of 6 mm. After closed treatment, residual displacement of the greater tuberosity of greater than 5 mm will most likely result in altered rotator cuff biomechanics. The greater tuberosity is draped by the confluence of the posterior superior rotator cuff tendons with the anterior half of the greater tuberosity insertion composed of the supraspinatus fibers and the posterior half composed of the overlapping supraspinatus and infraspinatus fibers. The greater tuberosity fractures with residual displacement of less than 5 mm after closed treatment tend to yield great outcomes with non-operative management. When displacement is greater than 5 mm or 3 mm in active patients, surgical treatment is warranted as the resultant malunion of the rotator cuff attachment site can cause limitation in active abduction and external rotation. Bissell et al. Investigated the epidemiology and risk factors of humerus fractures among skiers and snowboarders. They reported that the incidence of humerus fractures among snowboarders was significantly higher, 50% higher, than that of skiers, and that greater tuberosity displacement, greater than 5 mm, predicted the need for operative fixation. George reviewed greater tuberosity fractures. They reported that non-displaced and minimally displaced fractures may be successfully treated non-operatively, with surgical fixation recommended for fractures with greater than 5 mm of displacement in the general population or greater than 3 mm of displacement in active patients. They recommend close follow-up and supervised rehabilitation to optimize outcomes after both surgical and non-surgical treatment. Reviewing the incorrect answers, answer 1 is incorrect, as while a comminuted medial hinge would increase the likelihood of osteonecrosis of the humeral head, it would not directly alter rotator cuff biomechanics. Answer 2 is incorrect, as while an intact calcar length of 6 mm, which is less than 8 mm, would increase the likelihood of osteonecrosis of the humeral head, it would also not directly alter rotator cuff biomechanics. Answer 4 is incorrect, as anatomic neck displacement greater than 10 mm would be considered part of the near classification, and displacement of less than 10 mm has not been correlated with altered rotator cuff biomechanics. And lastly, answer 5, surgical neck displacement greater than 10 mm would be considered a part of the near classification, and displacement of less than 10 mm has also not been correlated with altered rotator cuff biomechanics. That is all for this review on proximal humerus fractures. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or the mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you are not already, please be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow, right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.